What's up, everybody? I'm Mike Wilson with Any Hour Services, and we're extending our free furnace sale. We still have a few more open spots we're trying to fill on our schedule. Just to recap how the sale works, when you have Any Hour Services install a new air conditioner, we'll give you a new furnace for just the cost to install it. About $400. The furnace is free. You just pay the labor. Call Any Hour Services and schedule your free estimate today. 801-443-7400. You can Google Any Hour Services. You can even schedule online at anyhourservices.com. No one helps more homeowners than Any Hour Services.
It's time to get that hernia repaired. And who better to do it than a leading clinical facility? JBR Clinical Research is currently recruiting participants for an investigational pain reduction medication study following hernia repair surgery. If you're between the ages of 18 to 75, you may qualify to receive study-related medication and no-cost hernia repair by a board-certified surgeon. You may even be compensated up to $2,000 for time and travel. To participate, call 801-261-2000 or apply at JBR Clinical Research. Research.com.
This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abual Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
I'm a very frazzled Rebecca Linland from Rebecca Drives.
So we're gathered once again for a Sunday episode of Wheel Bearings. The grace of proper cornering lines, the love of horsepower, and communion of enthusiasm be with you all. Let us now acknowledge our sins. Actually, let us not acknowledge our sins, for if they ever knew.
Unless they are beyond the statute of limitations.
Correct. Anyway.
Or you're planning to run for public office. Either, you know.
Welcome to the Church of Wheel Bearings. Anyway, let's talk about what we're driving. So, Sam, you have the Genesis G80.
I did. I had the, it's the new 2021 model year G80. So this is, you know, an all new vehicle. It's, you know, new platform. It's been redesigned, you know, like the last G80, you know, it has that fastback sedan kind of profile to it, but, it now, you know, it fully incorporates the latest Genesis design language, you know, which means oversized grille, which I can do without, but, you know, things like the lighting both on the front and the rear end, they've gone to this slim twin horizontal bar look that, you know, I think looks really sharp. You know, so it's the same thing that we've seen on the refresh G90 last year, excuse me, and also on the new GV80, and to a somewhat lesser degree on the refresh G70 that recently launched for 2021 as well. So this new platform that this thing is riding on is the same platform. They call it the M3 platform within Hyundai Motor Group. And it's the same platform that's shared with, the GV80, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which is the SUV. So really you can think of the GV80 as more of a tall wagon G80. More so than an SUV, but you know, I mean, that's what crossovers are now anyway. It's just, they're tall wagons. So, this has all the same hardware, same basic architecture, obviously rides lower because it's a sedan. But you know, same kind of interior design, the same dashboard and everything, which for the most part is great. You know, really love the look of this thing, both inside and outside. You know, the detail and the finished materials is fantastic, but there is the one flaw that we talked about previously, which is the central rotary controller for the infotainment system. You know, as we talked about before, unlike other systems like iDrive and Mazda's controller, you know, it doesn't sit up above the console. It's actually mounted flush in the console, and what you have is a knurled ring that rotates. You put your finger on it, and you can spin it around. You can also toggle it left, right, up, down like a joystick. And it looks really fantastic. But the problem is that knurling on that surface, you know, that's supposed to give you some traction so you can rotate it, it's not really quite. It doesn't have quite enough texture to it, and so what ends up happening is it's also a rocker, you know, left, you know, to select stuff and move up and down in menus and across the screen, you end up oftentimes, you have to push down hard enough on it, unless you're finger has an extra amount of texture, or you're using some stickum or something on your fingertip.
Use one of those things sorting. Unless you're,
maybe a little rubber finger.
Unless you're a piano player with really strong hands.
Right. Well, it's not so much that you need strong hands, but it's just the amount of force that you have to apply to get it to rotate. You know, if you don't have enough traction with your fingertip, if your fingertip is too smooth and you don't have quite enough traction, then oftentimes you end up, you know, rocking the thing and making a selection instead of just rotating it. And, you know, after driving the GV80 for a couple of hours, you know, I thought, well, I'll give it a chance, you know, once I've had a chance to use it a little bit longer. And, you know, after a full week with the G80, I think it's still not good enough. They need to change the texture on that one component. On all the other stuff where you actually, you know, the rotary shifter is just behind it, and that actually sticks up. And, you know, things like the turn signal stocks and the wiper controls, they have the exact same texturing on there. But because of the nature of the way that infotainment controller is set up, where it's flush in the console, and you do have to press down on it with some force to get enough grip to rotate it, you often end up, you know, hitting the switches and toggling something that you didn't want to. And so I think that needs a little more refinement. They need to change the texturing on that particular piece.
Well, the key, as we worship at the altar of automobile enthusiasm, is to be free from want. And so you're never going to need to use the controller.
Anyway, I had the same experience because I also had the G80, although that's not my primary vehicle I want to talk about. But I have another vehicle I want to talk about. But I had the same issues with it. And in true engineering form, Sam, you have dialed down, drilled down to the actual problem, which is that you end up selecting things in the infotainment system that you didn't want. And it's funny because I remember on my drive in New York City, there was a lot of feedback that people gave about the infotainment system. And I'm wondering if it's actually more that, like, I didn't find that controller to be intuitive, but because it didn't do the things I wanted it to do. It didn't spin when I wanted it to spin, and it didn't, like, I wanted to press on it and have it just have the push down activation, then select whatever the cursor was on. And it didn't always do that. And I think that it is a function of the design of it, that traction that you may not get. And just, it ended up being really frustrating. Now, I will say that in my week with the vehicle last week, it does have touchscreen, which I know you'd hate, but it was easier for me to use the touchscreen.
Touchscreen? I didn't.
Yes,
think it was a touchscreen. Okay,
it's a touchscreen. Yeah, so it's a long reach, so it's not ideal.
It's a 14-inch screen.
Right, so it's quite a long reach, but touchscreen is an option there, or avail. I mean, it's you can also use touchscreen. So I was able to get most of what I wanted done through the touchscreen mechanism because that flat rotary disc just was so annoying to use.
Yeah. So, you know, and the other thing that does work well on this vehicle is the voice control system. They do have a good voice recognition system.
Yes, they do.
And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this new platform, both the G80 and the GV80, you know, they have all the same hardware in there. And last week, NVIDIA announced that they are actually providing the chip that powers this whole system. It's based on their Parker system on a chip system, that's actually the processor that they used in their original Drive PX development platform for automated driving development. And it's the chip that was used in the original iteration of Tesla's version 2 Autopilot. So it's a very powerful chip, and you can tell, you know, the graphics on the screen, the interface looks great. I mean, very high resolution.
Yeah,
it's very attractive to look at. The system runs smoothly. It never stutters. It's very responsive. So the voice recognition actually works really well in this thing because again, it's powered by quite a powerful chip, which is great. But it's just the physical interaction through that controller, I think, is flawed. And I think it's a problem that can be fixed fairly easily. It's just a matter of they have to change the texturing on that surface, I think, so you have a little more natural traction with less force on the controller. And then when you do press harder, then you can use it to select and toggle.
So almost emboss it more, right? Like make it more of a dramatic, because I'm trying to think of like how you don't really want to change the look of it and the integration, but just that the rim, if you will, like that area where your fingers are touching, that touch point, that needs to just have a more pronounced feel to it.
Yes, exactly.
So I've been trying to look for photos. I had the G90. This is it different? Because I can't remember having the same trouble.
Yes, it is different.
Okay. Yes, yeah. This is coming out in the GV80 and the G80 first.
Okay, so it's new. I should wait to yell about it.
Yeah, it's brand. Yeah, you wouldn't have found it in any previous vehicles. It is a completely new design, and like I said, it looks really great. It's just that that one flaw, and everything else about this car, I really enjoyed driving. The G80 I had, I didn't have a chance. When we talked about the GV80 last time, I didn't have a chance to drive the 2.5 liter, the base GV80. I did this time around with the G80. I had a 2.5 liter rear wheel drive, and it was the Prestige trim level, so it was the high end trim level with the four cylinder. This is a 300 horsepower. 2.5 liter four cylinder, and 311 foot pounds of torque. It's got more than enough performance for this vehicle. It's not a problem at all. And I had no other complaints about this thing. I really like the way it drives. The ride quality is excellent. It's quite responsive. The seats are fantastic. Lots of room in the back seat. Very impressed with that. Let's see what else. Just trying to find the.
You're right, Sam. There's a ton of room in the back, and then also I love how the passenger seat can go really, really far forward. Mm-hmm. If you ever have that circumstance, but even like while even doing things like it's designed obviously for. If you have a chauffeur or something as exotic as a driver, but it also can come in handy even when you're putting kids in the car, when you're trying to do something in the back seat. I think it's a really interesting design and something that we as Americans wouldn't necessarily be using on a regular basis. But that passenger seat goes almost all the way up to, you can put it all the and get like a, I don't know, probably 6 or 8 inches of room back there for just whatever you need to do. And so I think there's a surprising amount of utility in the vehicle, although I do wish that they had actually gone the A7 route and made it a hatchback, because
I agree.
They could have easily done it.
Yeah, it would be better as a hatchback, I think. Then you have that option, to fold down the back seat. You've got a whole bunch of space back there if you need to carry larger items, and a large opening to put stuff in, if you're carrying larger items. And this has that very similar kind of profile to something like the A7.
Yes.
So it wouldn't even really change the look, the aesthetic appearance of it. It's just, it would change the functionality.
It would. And it's such a beautiful, beautiful vehicle. I mean, I find it really turns heads, and I just love the lines of it. The color, I had that Saville silver color that was just absolutely delicious. I mean, it's this really warm, rich gray that I think really stands out. And of course, just the driving experience. So I actually had the 3.5 liter V6 with all wheel drive. And I mean, that thing was fun. You could get up to a nice level of speed on that thing. Just saying.
I was going to say, you are the most responsible among us. You are
totally responsible.
mine was the Porto Red. Like a burgundy color. Really fantastic.
So,
and the other thing I loved about it was the materials inside. I loved that matte open pore wood feel, and I just thought the leather, the stitching was really beautiful. I mean, this is, you know, it's a $69,000 vehicle, but you also feel like you're in a $69,000 vehicle.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think. I'm sorry, Sam. I think they're actually probably one of the top companies right now in terms of executing design and making it feel appropriate or even better than the price on the sticker.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of these products were designed when Manfred Fitzgerald, who came from Lamborghini, when he was running Genesis. And so, you know, Manfred is a very worldly character and very, very elegant, very sophisticated. And, you know, I've never seen him with a wrinkle on anything.
Oh, so he's like us. I got it.
He's just like us. Well, and let me tell you a quick story about Manfred.
He's like the mirror version of us.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. We're his spirit animals. So I'll tell you a quick, this was just remarkable to me. So I was at a Genesis event and we were waiting for it to begin. And it was kind of, we were kind of hanging out. We're still waiting for people to arrive, I should say. And I was debating about what color to make my business cards for Rebecca Drives. I had a white version and I had a navy blue version. And I thought, why not ask Manfred? We're standing there chatting. And so I said, can I show you something? He's like, of course. That guy took like 5 minutes looking at my business cards.
That's
and
awesome.
I figured, it was amazing, you know, and I was like, it's okay. He goes, no, I'm thinking about you. I want it to reflect you, your business, what you're doing. And he goes, I think the navy blue is just different and eye-catching. I mean, he gave me an entire dissertation on my business cards.
That's how we think. Yeah. I'm not a automaker sort of designer, design chief, but sort of leading a creative team. That's how we think. That's what we do. You have to come up with the story as you're coming up with the concept.
Exactly. But, you know, for the CEO of Genesis to take that time on something as relatively trivial as the color of my business cards,
because there is nothing trivial.
Well, exactly. But that attention to detail is reflected in the products that were designed under his tutelage.
Yeah, and, you know, I wonder, it would be really interesting to ask at some point, coming from Lamborghini, you know, small, I know they're owned by Volkswagen, but a small niche manufacturer, to a large automaker like Genesis, that allows you to do things that you can't do. You know, exotics, everybody talks about how the dashboards are covered in leather. You know why? Because there's such small volume automakers, they can't afford the molding to make high quality plastic pieces. So it's like all of those things that you can now do that at the scale of a large automaker making volume cars that you can't do as a small exotic. That it would be interesting to hear what that experience was like, and maybe it wasn't anything, because, you know, Volkswagen to Hyundai, Kia, they're kind of not that different in terms of parent organization size.
Yeah, no, but you're right though. I mean, certainly, you know, the marketing budgets and such at Lambo are significantly smaller. I mean, we've had friends that work at Bentley at other, you know, and they're like, yeah, we have no budget, you know, and so it's what they focus on. I think that I think that his experience at Genesis, you know, he was really able to make his mark on this brand. I do think that, you know, and I don't want to speak for him, but I do think that, you know, the dealer network was difficult to kind of, you know, there's been a lot of, he inherited a lot of challenges when he came into the position. But it certainly, you know, I think that the brand would have been well served to have kept him on, but we're seeing the fruits of his labor in these products.
Yeah. So Sam, I totally didn't mean to cut you off like 5 minutes ago.
I know, right? Sorry.
I don't even remember what I was about to say.
I think you were talking about the price of yours. So what did yours
come up? Yeah. Mine was, because it's so new, it actually didn't come with a Monroney sticker.
Yeah, mine didn't either.
Yeah, so I priced it out. The Porto Red is a $400 option, by the way. So the base price on the 2.5 four-cylinder rear-wheel drive is $47,700. All in, including delivery, mine came to just over $58,000, which, you know, I think for a vehicle of this type, you know, something competing against, you know, a BMW 5 Series or, you know, a Mercedes E-Class, I think this is, you know, I think that's an excellent value. And as it always has been with Genesis, you know, they're always a great value. But, you know, when you sit in this, you look at it, you drive it, it doesn't feel like it's, you know, a step down from any of those German premium brands. It feels like it belongs in that group.
And so that was the rear wheel drive version, right?
Yes.
Okay. Mine was like the top of the line, all wheel drive, the whole thing. But I think for almost $10,000 less, how much is the all wheel drive premium? How much do you have to pay for all wheel drive? It's a couple thousand more, I think.
It's $3,000 extra.
Okay, so like for 7,000 more, you're getting the 3.5 liter, and I don't know that it's worth it. I think that four cylinder is so good that I think you're good with the 2.5 four cylinder. Personally, I mean, I haven't driven both of them, you know. I found the same thing on the GV80. I was really, really surprised and very, very happy with how that four cylinder drove. So, you know, save yourself some money. And I mean, that 3.5 liter.
In the case of the GV80, there is one other distinction. If you do want the third row, the optional third row, you do have to get the V6.
Yes.
It's not available with a four cylinder.
That is true.
That's clearly not an issue here. You know, there is no third row.
Right.
If you do want the third row in the GV80, you're going to have to step up to the bigger engine.
Yeah, but I mean, they're these products, as we've said for now several years, the Genesis products are really stunning. But I feel like now they've come to the next level, and the performance is being matched by the accoutrements and the materials and the looks, and everything's kind of blended together and synthesized into a really, really good product.
Agreed.
All right. So what was the car you wanted to talk about? Rebecca, you teased us a little, so now I kind of want to know.
So I had the 2021 Mazda CX-9. I had the signature. It's their large three-row SUV. It carries up to six people. And it's like the Genesis, you know, it's a really nice looking vehicle. It has the signature line, which I had was top of the line.
It is lovely. It is lovely. Yeah.
It is. It's beautiful. The interior is stunning on it. And it has a special grille on the front of it. The one I had is all-wheel drive, retails for $46,000, has a 2.5 liter engine in it, 250 horsepower, a six-speed automatic, which I loved, as opposed to a super whiny, annoying CVT. So I liked having, you know, the gears and all that good stuff. It was really, really nice looking. I think that I had a couple of issues, and I think it's important that our listeners know that when we have these issues, a lot of times we will contact the manufacturer, or in this case, there's a small group on Facebook of female journalists that I'm part of. And so I asked them, my problem with this vehicle, and I was really surprised, was that I couldn't get a comfortable seating position. Obviously, I'm short, and it's not something I talk about a lot in terms of criticizing a vehicle, but it was just really weird. I kept having to make adjustments to the seat. I felt like I was sitting, I felt like in order to see over the hood, I needed to sit up really high, but the slope of the windshield doesn't allow you to sit up that high. It makes a really close cabin. So like my head felt like it was hitting the top of the roof.
You just got to jump it less. That's all.
Yeah. I mean, it was just something that I really, really struggled with. And so you know, I reached out to my friends that are in this small group. One of them happens to be somebody at Mazda. And so she then, you know, contacted me separately. And I just said, you know, I had a hard time kind of getting into an ergonomically friendly position for me. And another one of my friends, Jill Simonello, is only, she's like 5'1" at most, right?
No, she's not even, I think she's like 4'11".
Is she 4'11"?
She likes to hide in trunks, doesn't she?
So she yes.
That's her.
Which is a whole nother discussion. But so she didn't say that she had those kinds of issues. So I don't know. I've been told before that I do prefer a very high seating position, like on the racetrack. I remember one of the pro drivers said, you know, try and put your seat a little bit lower, a little bit more forward.
Yeah, but when you're used to a throne, it's really hard. Yeah. You know, like...
Well, you know, it also, you know, it depends. You know, one of the things with seating positions is it's not just your overall height, but it's also your proportions. Not everybody has the same proportion of leg length to torso length.
Right. Well, and it's so right.
That's
right.
That's like... That's going to impact how you where you feel you need to sit in order to get comfortable.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And feel safe.
I have a very, very short torso. So
that's probably why you want to sit a little bit higher than perhaps Jill, you know, who's actually just, you know, an inch or two shorter than you. But, you know, I think her proportions are slightly different.
Right. I think so too.
I've been accused of sitting very close to the wheel too. Like close and high, because it's the sight lines thing. Like I need to be able to see out, and a lot of cars are difficult because they either have a fast windshield angle or, you know, the cowl is high or a combo, and you can't really discern where the front edges are, and it's disconcerting.
Well, and I had the same issue. I remember having a windshield angle issue with visibility in the Mazda 3. And I think part of it was that just the way that the sun was hitting at that time of year, it was late autumn when I had it. It just was, I don't know. And I do remember also on numerous occasions hitting my head as I got into the vehicle on the Mazda 6 and having to kind of be aware of where the A pillar is. So I think a lot of it is related to the angle of the windshield. And again, it's not a reason not to purchase. It's just a reason. It's just something to be aware of. When you go to test drive a vehicle, make sure that you have a comfortable seating position. There's so many vehicles out there. There's no reason to be uncomfortable. And if you can't get it comfortable at the test drive, that feeling is only going to get worse. You know, like you're constantly going to be playing with it, and it's annoying. So that was one kind of disappointing thing from my perspective. But again, that's a very personal, anecdotal.
But it's also very valid, because, you know, everybody's different sizes and shapes, and
right.
You know, it's you know, you got to, you know, as you mentioned, you know, you need to sit in it, you know, whatever vehicle you're considering buying, you need to sit in it and make sure you can get comfortable in that particular vehicle.
No, you're right. And the thing is that, you know, what's funny is that even though I'm only 5 feet tall, and this may be TMI, but so my inseam is actually 30 inches, which is long. And a lot of guys actually
look at the legs on that.
I look at the leg. Oh my God. Right. But you know, it's funny because you're right. The proportions make all the difference. And so it's, you know, again, like it's just how you sit in it. It is a personal experience, but you're right, Sam. And thank you for validating me. I'm no longer triggered. So
no, it's true. I mean, we talked about this last week too, with the head restraints and the seating position. You know, the design of this stuff, it's not going to work for everybody, and that will be a deal breaker. You know, I'm not going to buy a car that I'm not comfortable in, regardless of everything else.
You know, another example, you know, years ago, back in, I think, 2008 or something, Jim McCraw and I were at the launch drive for the BMW X6, the first generation. And Jim and I both climbed in and sat in the back seat of the X6. I'm 5'11". Jim is 6'4". He's five inches taller than I am. But my head was touching the ceiling in the back seat, whereas he had... you know, a good couple inches of clearance, just because our body proportions are so different. Even though he's taller, my head was the one touching the ceiling because I have a longer torso. So, you know, it's a very personal thing that everybody needs to be aware of when they're deciding what they want to drive.
Exactly, exactly. So the other issue that I had with, again, and I, the Mazda, it's such a good vehicle. It was lovely to drive. There was such good things about it. But once again, I have managed to break the infotainment system.
They should just hire you for user testing.
You know, I was at CES and I did speak with somebody at, I think he was at Samsung about being a tester because I do use things differently than everyone else. But this again is another example where I've reached out to Mazda and they have gotten back to me and they did confirm this. So this is the situation. So I activated Android Auto, and when I did that, I suddenly couldn't use any of the native voice recognition commands. And remember, Mazda doesn't have touch screen. Okay. So that, so basically you're down to the dial. That's your only option. But when you are in Android Auto or Apple CarPlay, and they confirm this for me, they deactivate the native voice recognition commands. So now you cannot use, you can't control it by voice and you can't control it by touch. Your only option is that dial. And that dial has what, in Android Auto at least, the cursor was very, very pale. It was really hard to find where the cursor was on the screen. This also, and like for like Waze, but I also ran into an issue where because the native functions don't work, I couldn't change the radio station. You can't even change the band that you're listening to. You can't do anything. Everything is activated through your phone. So for instance, it wanted me to log into my account on Sirius XM, which I don't typically have to do. So I'm not logged in on my phone.
Really? That's what? I don't.
Yes.
Oh, because it won't use the in-car tuner. It's going to stream it through your phone.
Exactly.
That's
they
dumb.
Assume your everything has to go through your phone.
Is that and so? I'm sorry. I don't want to get ahead of you. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. Because it's like, wait, what? So they found their research, quote, research found that people don't change the radio station very often. And so that was not a priority, which I found fascinating. I don't know. Maybe more people are streaming and I'm just really far behind, but I couldn't get AM, FM, or XM. I actually I got home fairly late from a program driving back from LaGuardia, and I drove in silence because I wanted Waze to be activated. And because of that, I couldn't turn any sound on, any audio on in the vehicle. And they confirmed that this is the design.
I think that's a terrible design decision. And you know, in general, I really like Mazda's approach, but that is an area where I think that they have made a mistake. And I had the CX-5 last week, and it's got the same infotainment system in there. And I also had a completely separate problem where Android Auto wasn't showing up at all in it. It didn't appear in the menus. I contacted Mazda and they said, should be there. We're not sure what's going on. I suspect it may have been a pre-production vehicle with an older software build that, you know, didn't have it enabled or something.
You talked about that issue before.
Right. And I plugged in an iPhone and tried that. CarPlay worked fine, but it did have the same issue as you had with Android Auto, where when you have CarPlay active or Android Auto, the embedded voice recognition system is disabled for some reason. Every other manufacturer that does this, typically what they do is, you know, you have the voice button on the steering wheel. If you just give it a quick click once, it'll bring up the embedded voice recognition system. If you hold it for a second or two, then it'll activate the phone's assistant. So either Siri or Google Assistant.
Well, that's a little opaque, though. How do you figure that out? Like, is that, you'd obviously need to read the manual and have somebody tell you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I figured it out by accident several years ago. When I tried, I pressed and held the button and it brought up the Google Assistant.
Which I guess that kind of brings up the point, right? So, that these cars are so sophisticated. Yeah. The automakers, the dealers, like part of it needs to be a training session to walk you through it.
Yeah, but I tried to use Google Assistant, and because I didn't have streaming services activated, I could not use the audio that's built into the vehicle. So, everything has to go through Google Assistant. And like, you know, so, and I ended up not on my drive home from the airport, but a couple of days prior to that, I found myself on the side of the road
trying
to change the radio station. Yes. And that is never appropriate in any circumstance.
Yeah, I think I've had that issue with Mazdas too. What did I have recently? The CX-3 or CX-30. And I think that was one of the things I noticed, and I just dealt with it by just unplugging the phone. You know, it brings up a good point where they talk about their testing and like, well, we found that people don't use they don't tune the radio that much. Okay. So that's going to be the engineer speak or the sort of software dev speak. They're going to say, well, those are edge cases, the people who do. Great. You want to talk about edge cases, you have to talk about the actual amount of people, not the percentage, right? So when you get like Facebook, right, talking about edge cases, Facebook has 2 billion users. An edge case of 1%, that's 20 million people, right? That's a shitload of people. Like, so they're not edge cases at that point. Like, that's a lot of people that your crappy design is going to harm. And I got that whole thing from, here it is, Ruined by Design, the book by Mike Montero, which I'm working my way through. And it raises good points. You know, designers are responsible for the things that they put out into the world. And this almost strikes me as irresponsible. It's you can't explain it away with typical software development, you know, wave of the hand, be like, oh, well, that's not that many people, or, you know, are the amount of users that we have, like most people do it this way. That's great. But you are talking about a 4,000-pound automobile that is hurtling down the road. You can't make it confusing. You have to make it easy because you're going to distract people. And
exactly,
they're going to crash into stuff. And
I mean, I was so distracted just trying to find the cursor in Waze, trying to find where it was, that I mean, I just I told Mazda this. I said, I can't in good conscience recommend this vehicle, especially because the touchscreen option is not available either. So they have taken away two of the potential methods of interfacing with this. And it was just, and again, like, we're, you know, trained professionals in quotes, you know, we should know what we're doing here. And, you know, they said, well, you were on the Mazda CX-30 launch. You didn't have these problems. I'm like, you're right. I didn't have these problems, but it's a good lesson for me to make sure. Cause oftentimes we don't listen to the radio on those launches because in the old days we used to have a driving partner and we would be chatting, but also we want to listen to the vehicle. We want to listen to the NVH, the noise, vibration, and harshness in the vehicle. So I almost never turn the radio on a test drive unless I'm actually testing the system.
Right.
But it's a good lesson for me to remember to really go through kind of an exhaustive process with the infotainment system. But yeah, this was just really, it's so frustrating because they've done such a beautiful job on this vehicle. It looks great. The interior is beautiful. The materials, the fit and the finish, that, you know, it was quiet. I mean, there's so many good things, you know, about it, but I just can't in good conscience recommend it with that infotainment system, the way that it's set up right now. Yeah,
and I'm curious though, like, is it actually a system limitation too, where it can't sort of mix those functions? And
yes. It's designed like that.
Yeah, but I think what Dan's saying is it a technical limitation that it can't do it?
And
my guess is it's probably not. I think it was a design decision rather than a technical limitation.
Like that. So that's bad design thinking. That's
right.
That's
well, you mentioned something earlier. You know, when I talked about, you know, with the voice button on the steering wheel, typically, you know, if you give it a single tap, you know, it'll bring up the embedded voice control. And if you press and hold, then it brings up the phone's digital assistant. And I think maybe the thinking behind this design decision was discoverability. You know, because, you know, again, as I said, I stumbled across that behavior by accident several years ago. And I've noticed that almost every vehicle does it that way. I think Mazda opted not to do that, perhaps because of the discoverability issue. They wanted consistent behavior, whatever mode that you're in. And I think, you know, there's some reasonable thinking behind this. You know, if, you know, whatever, if you happen to be using in the smartphone projection mode, they want to keep it focused on that. They don't necessarily want you jumping back and forth between different modes. If you don't have your phone connected, then, you know, you're using the embedded system, and that's the interface they want to give you.
Yeah,
I'm not saying I agree with that decision. I'm just trying to explain what I think might be the rationale.
Yeah, when you started talking out, right, that you can see how they may get to that decision point. But I think what I have found as a user is, you know, like we talk about the BMW cars with the gesture controls, and most people that I talk to, you know, they laugh about them or they don't like them. But okay, that's fine. You can either use it or not. There's three other ways to get information into that system.
Yes.
It's the same thing that you were just talking about, Rebecca, where they've closed off the avenues for interfacing.
Yes.
So when you're designing something that people are supposed to use, like people at large, not specifically trained users, you've got to meet them where they are, and you get to that lowest common denominator design point. So how do I make this easy? How do I make it understandable without somebody having to crack the manual? And that's really, really hard. So I'm not really casting too much aspersions on Mazda. They've thought about it. Some of the decisions don't really pan out in the real world. But when you make it hard to use the thing, like that's...
that's a problem.
That's bad. Yeah. It's not good.
So the other thing, so I'm just reading over my notes that I sent to Mazda. So the other thing is that I did finally figure out how to access the channel list by the rotary dial, but it starts at 1 or 87.7 or, you know, it starts 590.
The beginning of whatever band you're in. Yeah.
Yes, it starts at the very, very beginning every single time. Well, yeah. So basically, I mean, you know, from a consumer standpoint, it's a priority to, and we find this in other vehicles, it's a priority to program in your favorites. Okay, so that's an absolute. But God forbid you stray from your favorites, because you're not going to be able to listen. And you know, again, like I was with another manufacturer when I was getting these messages back from Mazda, and I do appreciate their attention and their response. But, you know, when I said, well, that Mazda found that people didn't change the radio station, they were like, wait, what are you talking about? Everybody changes the radio station.
And so, like, for me, what aggravates me is when I can't jump back and forth. I don't want to stream stuff on my phone. If I'm in the area where I can receive the broadcast, why would I want to stream it on my phone?
Yes. Or even, you know, what I find that I do a lot of times, first of all, if different people are in my vehicle, right, we want to listen to different music.
Right.
No, that's not how it works. I'm behind the wheel.
Is in control.
I pick what's on the radio.
Okay, you can tell I'm the youngest.
No, it just depends.
I never had those rights.
It depends on how magnanimous you're feeling.
No, you're right, because my dad would always change it just as we started to sing a song. Oh, he would change the channel. But no, you know, it's just, so I think we've bashed them enough, but it's just, again, it's something on a test drive that if you're a user that you never listen to the audio in your car, that's fine. Except that this also applies, like if you're in Waze,
yeah,
you know, if you don't want to, and what's interesting too, is that, you know, a lot of manufacturers, typically on the, you know, more economical vehicles, they don't even put navigation in anymore. So you are forced to use Waze, or, you know, you're forced to use Android Auto or Apple CarPlay. So this decision is just, it's really baffling to me. And the fact that all three of us, you know, kind of regardless of how we use it, I think we all think in different ways. We all bring something different to the table. And I think this is something that we all can agree on, is just, it's not safe. And that's my number one issue with it.
You know, what we need to do is we need to make a checklist of, you know, these are things that you need to try out when you go to test drive a car you're thinking about buying. Make sure you try all of these things before you walk away or before you sign anything. and make sure that you're comfortable with the way that that functions. We should do that in post.
Absolutely.
Get right on that, Dan.
I will. Yeah. I was going to say, you know, since we're officially a corporation, we can create a design and testing consultancy. And they can just send us the cars and $1 million, and we'll give them a large report.
There you go.
maybe not $1 million. I'll cut them a break. But it's like, this is a big part of designing cars, and it's something that seems to me that you could actually make it easy even for those people who don't, you know, that, okay, most people are not going to do it, but the people that will, like, it's not hard to put that function in. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, otherwise the CX-9 is lovely, although I wish you tried it in the summer, because my one complaint about the CX-9 was that the AC felt a little weak, but I haven't had one in years. So that was when they first launched this generation of CX-9, the AC had a hard time coping with a summer.
Interesting. I mean, I will say, you know, it was an all black interior with some slight brown wood accents to it. But again, you know, this was $46,000, which is a lot of money but it's a 7C or 6C rather.
I mean, something like that. I mean, its biggest natural competitor obviously is going to be like the Telluride or the Palisade at this point.
Yeah, which I still...
And they're larger.
They are larger, and I still do love those vehicles. But, you know, this had really nice quilting on it. Very, you know, lovely diamond quilting, attention to detail. It's certainly, I mean, the third row is going to be cozy, as most third rows in this size vehicle are. But, you know, it had a nice, in the third row, you've got a nice center console situation. In the second row, it's kind of a captain's chair, not totally, because the center row does have a console in it. So accessing the third row, there was a good enough room, and there's actually a nice amount of cargo space, even when the third row is up, and then a lot of cargo space if you don't need that third row. So, you know, overall, I think it's a very, very good vehicle. It certainly should be on your shopping list, except that infotainment system, in my mind, I just can't in good conscience recommend it.
Okay, cool. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I had the Lincoln Corsair, which was really, like, I'm impressed by this. You know, I was looking for sales figures for how the MKC sold, because to me personally, I always forgot about the MKC, but I think it actually sold okay. But you know, with the Corsair, Lincoln, they're using a lot of fancy words and high-minded descriptions to launch this vehicle. And it's a luxury compact. It has a cool name, which is great. They don't need to expand on that in their press release. They talk about how Corsair is related to the Latin root of cursus. And I'm like, anytime you bring like the phrase curse near your car, like, stop it. You know, but this is the vehicle that Lincoln needs most, not so much to erase the memory of the MKC, but to better establish Lincoln as more than fancy Fords, because I never felt that the MKC really achieved its launch velocity past the Escape.
Did you have the 2020 or 2021?
I believe I had the 2020.
Okay, yeah, because the 2021 is not on the website yet, and I actually had a hard time even finding it on the consumer website, because it doesn't show up in Google results, so they need to work on their SEO.
You know, you don't want to necessarily be putting the SEO dollars behind a site that's not live.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I don't think there's any notable changes for the 21s anyway. I think it's basically carryover.
Yeah, it's probably details, because it just launched for 20. And I did.
Yeah, no, I was trying to find the 2020. So anyway, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
I digress.
I did have the top trim, so it had all the goodies and the all-wheel drive and the 2.3 liter engine and the, I think, it LED headlights and everything. And it's lovely. You know, they've pulled the styling elements from the Aviator and Nautilus, mostly the Aviator, down to scale down for the Corsair, and that's been successful. It's really good looking. And inside, same thing. It's really, really nice. Lincoln has made an effort, and it's paying off, to have a cohesive family design language. And we can talk about how sort of derivative it may be. These are classic design themes. You know, everybody's going to pick up a little bit of sort of Bentley or whatever in the grills and stuff. Okay, that's fine. It looks good. Who cares?
So is this competing with like the Audi Q5?
It's
a 5-seat, right? Yeah. So I'm just trying to, because it's so hard to discern the size, and I didn't get a chance to get into the city. They had an event late Friday afternoon that I was not going to venture in for.
So this is Q5 X3 Lexus NX kind of size class.
Okay. Yeah.
And in that class, it's really, really competitive. They have made a real big effort. The interior is lovely. It's nice materials, great design. Ergonomics are pretty good. It's pretty easy to use everything. What is it? Sync 4 now? What do they call it?
No, it's still Sync 3 on this one.
Okay. Either way, pretty well done. You know, infotainment is you're going to use it a lot, and it's good here. The tech is really sort of unobtrusive, and it has all of the cameras and the blind spots, and I actually triggered the auto braking by mistake.
Did you? Yeah. Well done.
You're backing up.
No, when I was coming off an exit ramp, we're actually coming down an exit. Like,
oh,
I was behind. I was following a group of traffic, and I didn't. Yeah, I was.
You tell. Yeah.
Anyway, it thought I was a little too close.
It was demonstrating how, you know, modern advanced driver assist systems make drivers complacent and lazy.
I was driving aggressively, and I wanted people out of my way, and they decided they were going to slow down even more and take the exit before mine, which would have been okay. And I would have reacted, except for the car got the jump on me and decided to deploy like full anchor on the highway. I'm looking in my rearview mirror like, oh, I'm going to get completely run over here.
I do have a question about that.
Yeah.
Does automatic front braking activate the brake lights in the back?
Yeah, I believe it does. Yeah,
it does.
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to confirm that one day.
Anytime the D-cell is greater than like 0.05 Gs.
Okay. But even in adaptive cruise control,
yes.
Does it?
If it's hitting the brakes that hard, yes. Yeah. Most of the time, you know, like for ACC, most of the time your D-cell is low enough that it's not going to activate the brakes.
Right.
But if somebody cuts in front of you and the ACC hammers,
sure,
it's the brakes, it's going to turn on the brake lamps.
Okay, but it doesn't necessarily do that when it's just slowing more gradually.
Yeah. Right.
If you had your foot on the brake.
Yeah, it's a threshold based on the amount of deceleration that you have. And this also applies to regenerative braking. You know, if you're using an electric vehicle with strong regen, it's going to turn on those brake lights as well.
Yes, and that was one of the things that I wondered. And I finally, like, I look for the glow, especially at night, just to confirm.
Yes, yeah.
Because sometimes the systems if you put them in B mode or whatever, you just get the most regen for one pedal driving.
Right.
It can make you concerned that people are going to clobber you from
behind. Well, exactly, yeah. I'm here to to ask those questions, and you're here to answer them.
Those are good concerns. So it's good that it has safety tech. But the thing that impressed me most, I think, was it just feels like a very appropriately fancy cabin. And we've spent years and years with Lincolns that were really not less distinct. And so they're really finding their footing to be very distinctive. And they have a Lincoln way of operating. You know, this has the piano key shifters, which it's mostly successful, but it's not any easier than a dial or a traditional shifter. They tuck in nicely, so they don't take up much room, so they free up console space. That's fine. I kept reaching for a shifter for a couple of days. but that's okay. You know, some of the design decisions, it does have nice open pore wood in places and good leathers in this trim level, which is the top trim, so it has the best materials. In some places, there's that piano black plastic, you know, shiny black plastic. And I'm not sure that that's going to hold up, but okay. I was even surprised the multi-way Lincoln seats, the super adjustable ones, they make an appearance here. And I've fought with them in the past, but I was able to find an agreeable position with this version of them versus some other.
Well, these are slightly less super adjustable than the ones in the bigger Lincolns.
Yeah.
I think these are like 14 way as opposed to the 30 way seats in the, like the Navigator.
That's
Aviator.
Too many ways. That's
got too much time fidgeting with it.
Yeah.
I like where the voice recognition button is on the steering wheel, yeah, or was that annoying?
No, yeah. I thought it might be like I'd hit it by mistake and stuff, but no,
right.
it's in a really good spot, and it's distinct. So it's up there where your hands are going to be anyway. So I like that spot too.
Yeah. And I also like where the cruise control buttons are, because in some vehicles I found they have a stalk, which is often hidden behind the steering wheel.
Yeah. Yeah, Toyota, especially Mercedes.
BMW does that.
Yeah,
which is really annoying. But no, this looks really nice.
No, it's for this kind of vehicle. Like, this is where all the sales are happening in this segment, and for premium cars overall. And it's a very good effort here. It drives with good discipline. The 2.3-liter has plenty of power, although the standard, like the 2-liter engine that it comes with, is a 2-liter turbo. This is 280 horsepower, 310 pound feet with the 2.3-liter turbo, because I had the reserve. So the standard Corsair has the 2-liter turbo with 250 horsepower and 275 pound feet. So that's a noticeable difference, but it's not that much. And I think that one of the things that you're going to miss out on is whatever kind of fuel economy you can get out of it, because it's just not, it's a little thirsty for what it is. And I remember that from the Escape as well, that I had with this engine. It'll hustle, no problem, but it's going to spill fuel while it does that.
Well, they do. There is a plug-in hybrid version of this coming. It was actually supposed to be launching about now, but because of some issues they had with batteries, they actually pushed back the launch until into the first quarter of 2021. But there will be a plug-in hybrid version that has over 30 miles of electric range and all electric all-wheel drive. So there's an e-motor on the rear axle.
Oh, that'll make a big difference. And it'll change the attitude a little bit too. Where you just get that nice shove from behind. You know, functionally, the cargo space is good. I love the hatch design that overlaps the edges of the rear quarters. They stole that from Audi, but whatever. Great artists steal. and I think that helps make the hatch opening maybe a little wider than it would otherwise be. And you don't have to worry about bashing the taillights that are left with, you know, some, like you take it to the home improvement store and you're trying to load some lumber or something, because everybody does that with their luxury crossover, right?
Of course. Did you have the Reserve 2 equipment?
Yes.
That's like an $11,000 package.
It is, but it replaces the Reserve 1, which I think is like a $6,000 package, right? So
But it's $8,000 more.
Yeah, but
wow.
What's the total tally come from? I didn't.
So now you're getting up. I'm at 55.2 right now.
Yeah,
and as I build this, there's a $700. Iced mocha selection if you want, or ceramic pearl. So there are some
paint colors.
Some paint colors that go for about $700. And then you can get a $1,600 appearance package. Although no, that's part of it.
Right.
So, and then let me just look at the wheel types. You can add $1,200 wheels.
None of those are really offensively priced though. Like if you want the stuff, you're going to pay for it.
Yeah.
$1,200 for a set of wheels is not,
it's not bad.
Yeah.
No, and they're pretty good. There's actually there's another one that's actually $1,600 that are fabulous though. So I would go for those. It's not going to change your payment much.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like even if you fully load it up, I expect that it's probably not going to crack 70, 65, or maybe even less. Like I honestly don't know how high you can get the price.
I don't think I'm at 58 right now with my fancy wheels.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty close to that. And that's a really, really nicely equipped vehicle.
Yeah.
So you're at 58, which, yeah, I mean, that's not bad. It's $14,000 worth of options,
sure.
But you're getting, you know, you're really getting the different engine. You're getting a beautiful interior. You are getting some cool things there.
Yeah, and what would you pay for the Audi or for the BMW? Yeah. And
exactly, right.
You know, this drives every bit as well as those cars do. The 2.3, you know, its engine note isn't the smoothest, but it's quiet in here. It's quiet enough inside that my 12-year-old, who is prodigiously noisy in his own right, commented that rich people get to enjoy a quiet engine.
Great. I think that is one of the most important distinctions between this and the Cadillac XT4. Yeah, you know, the NVH in the Corsair, like other Lincolns, is just outstanding.
Oh, it's good. Yeah.
Fantastic job. Whereas the XT4, as much as it is fun to drive, you know, its NVH characteristics are bad. You get a lot of road noise coming through.
A lot of road noise.
Well, the thing, the Corsair doesn't really give up much on being fun to drive either. It's fun on a twisty road. You know, it'll hustle, and it feels good doing it. So that was one of the things I noticed about the Escape. It was like, this is a fun car to drive. And that's nice to have, even if you're just, you know, driving a compact crossover or a compact luxury crossover. So it's comfortable. It's quiet. It's luxurious, and it's a good time on a back road. Like that's a pretty hard combo. You know, the spider chart of that is tough to achieve. So they've done a really good job with it. The throttle calibration I felt was a little overeager, so it made it feel less smooth, I think, especially coming away from stops. But there's drive mode, so you can put it in conserve mode and it smooths out those inputs. You know, it's a really credible contender. I much prefer it over the Lexus. Well, I was thinking of the Lexus RX probably because we were talking about it last week. The infotainment is good, probably better for the class than a lot of others that are a little bit more Byzantine to use. Although I did feel like, you know, they've got buttons on the center stack, which is good, but the buttons aren't different enough, so you still have to look. And if you wanted to switch like airflow modes with HVAC, you press the button, which normally you'd expect it to cycle through the modes. No, it brings up more buttons on the screen this time, and then you get to poke at the screen to figure out where you want the airflow. So that to me was another one of those mistakes. Like, did you actually try to use this? Why would you make me press three buttons just to do one thing? Come on.
You can do it all by voice, though.
I watched 2001, man. You don't talk to machines. They will stab you in the back.
every time.
Open the pod bay doors. So yeah, the MKC was anonymous to me, and the Corsair, I think, helps get past that MK whatever naming scheme, so people aren't saying the Lincoln what. You say Corsair. It's a cool name. It sticks a little better, and the vehicle itself stands up to scrutiny. It's a really excellent turnabout for Lincoln. We, you know, a couple of years ago, we were talking about Lincoln dying, and I mean, I don't know what their sales look like. I haven't really delved in. I was poking around trying to figure it out last night, but their product is good, at least.
They did mention that because Michael Sprague is the head of Lincoln or some division of it or some part of it. He was on a podcast and mentioned that the new dealerships are actually seeing an increase in traffic, which is interesting, you know, because that's when you know, the dealer experience. I think when you're trying to revitalize a brand, you have to pay attention to that dealer experience. It's one of the big challenges that Genesis has, you know, that it doesn't have a separate standalone dealerships. So I think that Lincoln has, they need to really flex on that advantage that they have. They also, you know, have a great pickup and delivery services. You know, they can kind of pull some of the black label attributes of it and really appeal. I think, you know, this size of vehicle is so great, particularly for smaller households, for single women and men. You know, I think that there's opportunities here that Lincoln really could capitalize on with the right brand of marketing and the right dealer strategy and stuff. So I think I would like to be able to drive one at some point. There's a very limited fleet here in the New York area for Lincoln, but I think it's I think there's a lot of potential here.
It's yeah. really compelling. Yeah, it's very yeah. well.
For what it's worth, on Ford's end of September sales release, because they report quarterly, they still have the Corsair and MKC bundled together because they had a changeover partway through last year. But through the first 9 months of 2020, sales were basically flat for Corsair and MKC, which, you know, given where the market was as a whole, is actually really good. I mean, it's if the market in a normal market, it probably would have been up pretty significantly in that same period. So they've sold through the first 9 months of this year, they sold 18,000.
Wow.
All over 18,000 Corsairs.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, considering going on this year,
it's Lincoln's best selling vehicle.
Yeah.
By a pretty significant margin.
Yeah. So it gets my hearty endorsement, which is worth everything they paid for it. All right, let's move on to some topics. We can stay with Ford because their biggest news is that they finally lifted the curtain on the F-150. We saw it a while ago, and now we can talk about it. And Sam, you were able to get the full dog and pony.
I did. I did the media launch drive of the new F-150. Had a chance to drive several different examples. I spent the most time in a King Ranch Power Boost. So for 2021 model year, in typical automaker PR parlance, you know, the F-150 is all new, except, you know, it's mostly kind of new, not entirely new. But there's actually a lot more new under the skin than what is apparent from looking at it. You know, I mean, the design, you know, it's a natural evolution of what they've been doing with F-150 for the last couple of generations, especially the previous one. But it doesn't look radically different. The powertrains, you know, there's six powertrains for this year. Five of them are carried over from the 3.3 liter naturally aspirated V6, the 2.7 and 3.5 EcoBoost V6s, the 3 liter diesel V6, and the 5 liter V8. Those are all carried over. The only difference there is the 6-speed that used to be standard with the base engine is gone. It's now 10 speeds across the board. That's the only transmission they have in the F-150.
That's a good transmission.
What's new for this year is the what they call the Power Boost. That is the new F-150 hybrid. And so this is using Ford's modular hybrid transmission system, and this is the third application of it. We've already seen it in the Explorer, the Aviator Grand Touring, and now in the F-150. In the Explorer, they paired this transmission with a 3.3 liter naturally aspirated V6, basically the base engine from the F-150. In the Aviator, they put it with a 3 liter twin turbo V6. And because it's a plug-in hybrid, they also gave it a bigger motor. That Ford's hybrid system for these vehicles is basically, it's the 10-speed automatic, but they sandwich in an electric motor in between the end of the crankshaft and the input and the torque converter. So you have an extra that electric motor, you know, that can drive the torque converter and the rest of the driveline. And so the Aviator is the most powerful Lincoln ever produced, you know, 490 horsepower and 650 foot-pounds of torque. In the F-150, they paired it with the 3.5 liter EcoBoost. So 450 horsepower, 570 foot-pounds of torque, most torque ever in an F-150. So they didn't try to make this, I mean, it is actually quite fuel efficient, but they didn't, you know, maximize fuel efficiency like they could have in this thing. They went for functionality, you know, trying to enhance the capability of what an F-150 does. For example, this thing can tow 12,700 pounds. The last hybrid full-size pickup truck, you know, was the old GM two-mode hybrids that were built between 2008 and about 2012, which were very expensive and we're limited to about 6,000 pounds of towing capacity, and, you know, less than 2,000 pounds of payload. This F-150 is, you know, like 3,000 pounds of payload, 12,500 pounds of towing. You know, so this, the only, the, if you want more towing than this, you've got to go with the standard 3.5 EcoBoost, which can go up to 14,000 pounds. I spent the most time in the hybrid and was really impressed with it. A couple of years ago when they first started talking about it, one of the things that they highlighted at the time was that, you know, they were going to have a built-in power takeoff capability, you know, for, you know, basically use the hybrid system as a generator. Because what they're doing is, you know, they're thinking about, you know, who are our customers that actually use these things as a work truck. And you can, you know, while the one I drove was the high-end, you know, King Ranch luxury version, you can also get the same powertrain in an XLT, which, you know, is the, that's the high volume model. And that's the one that, you know, a lot of commercial customers use, that or the XL. The XL, the base XL is the only one where you can't get the hybrid. But the, you know, the, what they call Pro Power on board, allows you to get AC power. It gives you, with the hybrid, the base Pro Power on board system is a 2.4 kilowatt system. So you get four 120 volt outlets in the left rear corner of the bed. And that's on every single one of these hybrids. So you can plug in your tools, charger tools and things like that, which is great on a job site because a lot of commercial customers, you know, have to haul along a generator to power their equipment. Now you don't have to. And then there's also an optional 7.2 kilowatt Pro Power on board, which adds a 240 volt outlet in the back there. So you got a 240 volt NEMA
plug. So you
plug.
You can charge electric cars.
Exactly. So you can, you know, you can, if your Mach-E, your Mustang Mach-E runs out of juice, you can just plug it into your F-150 Power Boost and be ready to go in about 3 or 4 hours. But, you know, I think the biggest complaints, you know, that we've had about the F-150 in the past have been, you know, the interior materials and quality and fit and finish, especially when you compare it to the Rams. You know, the Rams have always been a step above, and they really Ford really stepped up their game with this generation of F-150. It's much better, much, much better. You know, even the base, you know, XL and XLT, you know, they still have mostly hard plastics, but the texturing on the plastics looks much better, feels better. You know, and they've done, you know, they've got some neat little touches, like on the XLTs at the front corner of the door panel, just below the mirror, there's a little trim plate there that has a silk screen map of Detroit on it. You know, so you can see where the truck was built. You know, there's a lot of other nice details. On the XL, the base XL, you can still get a column shift on that one.
And
a bench seat.
Three on the tree, man.
And they also
ten on
have
the tree, actually.
And you may be getting to this, but I love that interior work surface.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just going to get to.
Thing they have
on, you know, most of them now, you know, get sold with a console mounted shifter. If you get the console mounted shifter, this is one of the standard features for this year. There's a button beside the shifter. You press that, the whole shift lever motors down into the cavity in front of it and leaves a flat surface there. And then the armrest actually folds out. So the center armrest, you can open that up and you have a nice, large, flat work surface there, which is fantastic. You know, for contractors, plumbers, electricians, whatever, you know, if you've got your laptop there, you got to print out an invoice, you can put your laptop on there, or you know write stuff out if you're still doing it that way. So they've really thought about, and you know, we talked about this previously, you know, this whole idea of human-centered design. There's a lot of these little touches, you know, looking at how do people actually use their trucks, what are the things that they need, not just, you know, what kind of neat features can we put in here, but you know, what are the kinds of features that for someone who's using this as a truck, as a tool, what are the things that they would actually benefit from? And then putting those kinds of features in here. And it, you know, I think it works really, really well.
Yeah, I think that's what I found when I saw the vehicle back at the end of August. We weren't allowed to drive it, but I felt like they had just thought of so many things. There were so many conveniences, just the details were amazing. And I think they just did a really, really nice job appreciating and embracing their user. Instead of trying to tell people how to use the vehicle, they listened to how people use the vehicle. And I think that created those emotional solutions that people are looking for in a product, especially, you know, a pickup truck user, a lot of times they're, you know, it starts with they need a pickup truck, period. And they may have to compromise on other things like design, aesthetic or something. But if you can say you've got a pickup truck and we're going to, and we're also going to listen to how you use it, all those smaller features, those smaller details, I think they've done an amazing job on this.
That is their most important vehicle.
Oh, for sure. But they respect that, though.
Yeah, they are not going to screw it up.
No, they're not. But, you know, it still is. They've done a really, really good job of protecting this vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm impressed with the upgrades. You know, my biggest complaint about the F-150 has always been the interior quality for the price, at least for the last couple of generations. And I think the last time we talked, the impression was that it's much, much better.
It is absolutely way better. And, you know, among some of the other interesting new features, you know, on the higher end models, you can order what's basically a lie flat front seat, you know, kind of like a business class seat that, you know, they call it the max recline seat that goes back almost completely flat. You know, so yeah. If you need to take a nap, you know, in the middle of the afternoon or you're on a road trip. You
want who doesn't take a nap in the middle of the afternoon?
Of course. Well, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about working from home. You know, you can do that. But, you know, if you have to work outside the home, you know, and you work from an F-150, now you can do that in your F-150.
Well, you know, I'm waiting for them to just put an air mattress in the bed, though.
Like, no. They've got to have the built-in, like, so the cushion. Yeah.
Right.
You just press a button, the cushion pops up.
Yeah, exactly.
And creates, and that's what I want.
Yeah. Instead of the King Ranch, that'll be the King Size.
Yeah. another neat touch that you can get in the crew cab version is under the rear seat. So you can fold up the rear seat cushions in the back, and you can get this fold out storage car compartment. You know, so it's kind of like a little origami thing. You know, you can fold flat. So if you need a large flat surface inside that's locked away, you can have that. So you have a flat floor there. But then you just pop this thing up and you have a storage area there. It's probably about 6-7 inches high. It spans the full width of the cab, you know, and the depth of the rear seat. And then what you can do, though, is when you put the seat back down again, there's a keyhole there. You can actually take your key and lock it. So so you can lock stuff away inside, locked in the cab. So it's both not visible, it's out of sight, and it's locked away under the rear seat in this compartment. And also on either end of that, you know, when you have the seat folded up, there's actually there's hooks there that you can tie down. So if you have to put something large inside and you want to tie it down so it doesn't move around, there's tie downs inside the cab, you know, that are just stamped, you know, from the seat frame. You know, they put a couple of extra loops on there and you have places to tie down inside. So a lot of cool details like that really make it more useful. Also, you know, something, you know, you don't typically think of something like a full-size pickup as a technology leader. But the F-150 is one of Ford's first vehicles with their new electrical architecture that supports full bumper to bumper over the air software updates.
Is it also 48 volt?
It's not 48 volt. No. But it does have software updates for all the systems available for all the systems in the vehicle. So, you know, if they need to update the software for, you know, a problem with the seat controls or the mirrors or the powertrain, they can push out those software updates to you over the air. You don't have to go into a dealer. You can still go if you prefer to, you know, have a dealer do it. You can take it to your dealer and have them do it. But otherwise, you can just do it. You know, just wait and it'll just show up and be done. And then next year they will have the Active Drive Assist, you know, which is their version of Super Cruise, a hands-free, partially automated driving system. But if you order the prep package for it now, they install all the extra sensors, including the infrared driver monitor cameras. And on the F-150.
Oh, driver monitoring, that thing that other companies that do ADAS
that claim resist. You don't need it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What Ford has done is, you know, unlike Cadillac and GM, you know, where they have a single camera mounted on top of the steering column that's looking at you. Ford's actually got, in the F-150, they've got two. One is mounted at the lower front corner of the door, like right by the mirror. And then the other one is above the up to the upper right of the touchscreen, the 14-inch touchscreen. And so they're looking at you. The two of them are looking at you from different angles. So it gets around that problem that the GMs had, where if the sun was shining in from directly over your shoulder from behind, it could flood the camera and it wouldn't be able to see you, and the system couldn't activate. Because they're looking from different angles, you won't have that problem anymore. So even if one is flooded, the other one can still see you.
It's going to tell you, hey, put the phone down.
Exactly.
Yes. I also love the tailgate work surface, the mm-hmm. details in there. They've got a place where you can, I love the old school little pencil slots that they've got. You can actually use the tailgate. Right, there's a ruler. You can use the tailgate as a clamper, like as a clamp, so you can put clamps on that.
There's notches in there for C-clamps.
Yeah, and then, you know, of course, the plug is right there, so you can plug in the tool right there as well. It's really, what I liked, again, when I just saw it, I didn't get a chance to drive it, but it's like they had very specific people working on these different parts of the truck, and then it all came together in really, really nice synthesis of design. It's really cool.
Yeah, the truck market is where they clearly want customers to know how valuable they are. Mm. And I'm really curious what happens to the truck market if eventually we stop our protectionism and get rid of the chicken tax. I wonder, you know, part of the reason why trucks are like this is because they only compete with themselves among the domestic brands. You know, it's very expensive for an automaker to bring a production line here to the U.S. to produce domestically. The only companies that have done it really are Toyota and Nissan. And I'm not seeing anybody else really trying that, but there's a lot of trucks in the rest of the world that are interesting takes on it and different and more variety and better suited for some of the tasks that we just sort of push these full-size trucks into. So I'd be curious to see what happens if that eventually happens. But I mean, in the meantime, enjoy being coddled because it's nice.
Yeah, no, it's a great truck. They've done an excellent job updating it. And, you know, I think fairly confident that for the foreseeable future, Ford will probably retain their position at the top of the truck market.
I think they play around with numbers with that anyway. Like that's,
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, they don't say F-150 sales volumes; they say F-series. So right. This, you know, when they talk about, you know, 900,000 F-series last year, that also includes all the Super Duties. But those, you know, it's generally split about 2/3, 1/3 between the light duty F-150 and 2/3 light duty and then 1/3 heavy duty, the Super Duty trucks. And the same is roughly true for GM and FCA. That's usually split about 2/3, 1/3 between light duty and heavy duty.
Yeah. I mean, GM, like if GM were to report on their platform, like what is it, K2XX now for the trucks, if they were to say the amount of those, you know, vehicles sold on that platform, they'd probably outsell the F-Series.
Yeah, because GMC and Chevrolet are split. Yeah,
maybe
yeah,
not anymore, not, but because Ram is sort of coming up. Ram has jumped
yeah.
into
well, actually,
two,
F-Series still outsells the GM, the GM, the Chevy / GMC trucks combined.
Combined.
Because there were years that they didn't.
Yeah, right. There were some years where they didn't, but right now it does.
Yeah. So either way, there's a lot of trucks, and it's still impossible to find one that's used and in good shape for not $1 million. So super frustrating. Although I found one last night locally. It has the it's a 2004. It has the 8.1 liter Vortec, the Mark IV big block. And I sent my wife a text. I was like, I really want this truck. She's like, it's old. I was like, but it has the best engine, push rods.
All of 9-10 miles per gallon if you're lucky.
Yeah, I mean, it had a Fisher Minute Mount plow in the front too, so it's definitely going to get zero fuel economy.
Oh my gosh.
That's okay. It's an occasional vehicle. So Infiniti decided they wanted to restyle. I mean, are they calling it all new with the QX55, or is it?
It's a new model, a new nameplate. And they talked a lot about it being inspired by the FX.
And it's in between. It's a 55, not a 50 or a 60. It's a 55, right?
That's right. The thing is, the FX, and after Johann Dineischen had his way with Infiniti, which became the QX70, that was really kind of the first of the so-called SUV coupes. Came out about 5 years before the BMW X6.
Yeah, when did the FX come out? Was it
2003?
Yeah. Okay, early 2003.
And it was like, because it was like a bargain Porsche Cayenne. It was really
It was a nice looking Porsche Cayenne.
It looked great, and it was on the FM platform, so it drove well.
It was
fabulous.
It was the same platform as the Nissan Z.
Yeah.
And the Infiniti Gs and some other models.
So much fun.
The QX55, is a fastback SUV, but it's not really a direct replacement for the QX70 or FX. This is basically the so-called coupe version of the QX50. I mean, if you look at it's on the same platform as the QX50. Which we've talked about, and quite liked, just with, the back end sloping forward more. They tweaked the fascia a little bit. It's got a slightly larger version of the grille, a little more aggressive look, but, not notably different. And the taillights are a little different. But other than that, it's mostly the same sheet metal. Everything inside, is the same. Only the 2-liter variable compression turbo 4-cylinder. Unlike the QX50, no front-wheel drive version. All-wheel drive is standard. So this kind of sits just slightly upmarket of the QX50. They did hint, during the backgrounder. I don't know if you were on that call, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. They did hint at at some point in the future, perhaps bringing back a true FX replacement, new QX70. But they're not ready to talk about that right now. So this, this is kind of in that, mid-size segment, a little bit smaller than what the FX was, and certainly a lot less power.
Yeah, I love this thing. Just the looks of it. Obviously, we haven't driven it yet, but I am so
partial. Well,
you've driven
the QX50, right? I know Dan and I have.
I don't know if I have. I have to look back and see.
I mean, it's going to drive like a QX50.
Steven, get on it. Get on it, Steven.
I'm very partial to these fastback coupe kinds of looks because I just think they're...
It's good looking. It's really good.
Well, they scream, I don't have children. And so...
Or I do not care about my offspring's...
the headroom of my offspring. Yeah.
My offspring are this tall, they're on their own.
Exactly. I think it's really, really great looking. And I think that, Infiniti has, similar to Lincoln, Infiniti has really been in some ways its own worst enemy while it went through all those crazy name changes and while it kind of finds its place. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity here. I don't know that I've driven it. I only have the Q50. I just drove the Q50 sedan. That's the one that I took down to Virginia, coincidentally, with my girlfriend's 4 kids rotating in and out of it this summer. But I think that Infiniti, there's opportunity there that's been left on the table in the last few years. And I think there's a chance for them to come back with the right product, with the right marketing. The problem is, the challenge that they have is that this segment and the entire landscape has only become more competitive with companies like Genesis bringing in, like the GV80, obviously, I think it's not going to compete directly with this, but they're going to come out with more products that are going to compete with this. Lincoln the Corsair that we just talked about. So there, from a marketing strategy standpoint, Infiniti needs to continue to differentiate itself and give people a reason to purchase an Infiniti and make that argument, make that case.
Yeah, I mean, Infiniti, you know, for 30 years now has been a fascinating brand. You know, they've created some very interesting vehicles over the years, starting with the original Q45. I don't know. Did you ever have a chance to drive a Q45?
Mm-mm. That was probably when I was in Boston, I must have done.
I mean, that, you know, that the original first generation Q45 from that came out in 1990.
No, I wouldn't have done.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, when BMW or when Lexus and Infiniti launched, you know, within a few months of each other in 1990 or 89.
Yeah.
You know, they came out, Lexus, you know, had much more conservative design. You know, they were often compared to, you know, Japanese Mercedes-Benz, and Infiniti was the Japanese BMW. You know, and the Q45 had, you know, some hints of the 7 Series of the time, but it had that very unique front end with that massive badge, belt buckle badge, which, you know, to some people, you know, looked kind of goofy. And they certainly had a weird advertising campaign. Stones in the water.
They didn't show the product, remember?
I know.
Right.
They never showed. But, it's like one of the biggest misses in advertising. Yeah. For folklore.
But the car was great.
It yeah. was, which makes it all the more ridiculous. I'm, yeah. I'm don't get me started.
And the G's, you know, the G35 and, you know, and experience.
Oh, those cars are classics. Honestly,
those were fantastic too.
People may not think of them yet as classics, but the G35, G37, all the FM cars, like the,
yeah,
fantastic. They're
and the FX, you know, yeah, it's part of that.
Yeah,
they're a little quaint now in terms of like NVH and stuff. They thrum with energy, but they're super good to drive. They were really, really competitive against you know, stuff like the 3 Series, and they were different. They were a good, solid choice, and Infiniti has kind of walked back from that a little bit.
I think though, I mean, just anecdotally, if you ask journalists, if you had to choose between a Lexus and Acura and Infiniti, a lot of people would have said Infiniti because just the driving engagement was so fun.
Certainly back in the day, that was.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yes.
Today, I don't think you would get.
No, I don't think that's the case at all, which is unfortunate. I don't think we'd pick any of them.
No, I'd go with Acura. They have that good stereo.
I know. Stereo. Sorry.
I'm getting the new TLX next week. Right. So
I just drive it slow and play it loud.
All right. Any more thoughts on the QX55?
Looks good. Send them to us, Stephen. Come on, let's get on it.
Yes, exactly.
It'll be out next spring. So it's still a few
months off. Wah, wah, wah.
All right. So we do have one listener question this week, and that is from David Parker. And David actually heard me on the Tech Guy show with Leo Laporte, which I do every Sunday, and it says, I hope you have time to answer my question. I see the new Mustang has an app with a monthly fee. He's referring here to the Mach-E. Is that with all electric vehicles? Just being a regular guy, more cost per month plus electric charge. Makes me think more. It's like paying for a homeowners association with no pool, no park, no common ground. Help me with this. Is this what all EVs are doing? No, actually, you don't have to pay for the app for charging, you know, to use the app. I think my guess is what David picked up on here is an issue with the active drive assist, which is we've previously talked about this with Super Cruise. For the first 3 years of ownership, you will get, if you get the active, you'll get free Ford Pass Connect complimentary for 3 years. After that, you'll have to subscribe to a Ford Pass Connect plan in order to get the map updates and keep Active Drive Assist working, functional. So that's what you're going to pay for is the connectivity. But even without that, you know, the app itself, you don't have to pay for that. And in fact, the what Ford's doing with Mach-E and with other vehicles is they're building in charging into Ford Pass, so that when you get your car, when you get an electric Ford, you just set up your account one time, put in your payment information, and then from then on, when you go to charge your car, you know, if you go to a charger that supports plug and charge, like Electrify America, and I think Green Lots is doing this as well, You just plug it in, and it automatically bills you for the charging. You don't have to mess around with punching in your account number or tapping an NFC card on it or anything else. Just plug in. It will communicate with your car, recognize it, and it's all networked and, goes back and does all the billing authentication automatically, which is actually really nice. So the app itself, and, for things like, using the phone as a key or, preconditioning your cabin, if it's cold out, and you want to get it warmed up before you go, you can do all that through the app. There's no charge for any of that. That's all free of charge.
So what Ford is getting from that, though, so anytime the app is free, you are the product. And so what Ford is getting from that is they're getting information about how things are being used, where you're charging, and they can aggregate that data. And it's not nefarious per se. It's actually going to wind up making a better consumer experience because it's building in that research loop, that user testing. They're going to be able to see what people are doing and then better meet those needs. To a degree, they're still going to have to ask people, hey, what stuff don't we offer that you wish we did, and that kind of stuff. But I expect that the data and the learning that they get from having the free apps is very beneficial to even the buyer at the end of the day. With having to update stuff, I don't like the idea of a monthly subscription fee to a feature in my car. Stuff like the maps for the nav system, you've had to pay to upgrade those for a while, at least in some cars. I had to buy.
Yeah, used to be, you would have to go to your dealer
right.
and buy a new DVD,
right.
For $800
right.
and load that in, and it'll load up your new maps, for $800 every year. Which was, that was crazy.
Right.
I
had to do that with
expensive.
The Uconnect in our Grand Cherokee. I wanted to update the map. So I bought the update. And it turns out, A, the car needs to be running. B, I've got to update the OS first and then the maps. And it all came on a thumb drive. And then C, it's going to take 2 hours. It's going to sit in the driveway idling for 2 hours.
Oh my gosh, running?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm just like, really? So I just haven't gotten around to it yet, and that was $100 to upgrade the map. So there is some ongoing cost, and there's really no way to kind of get around that because, OTA updates haven't happened, and the systems are old enough that they take some labor to update. So actually, the over-the-air updates are going to be better. Paying for an update isn't probably a big deal. Paying a subscription fee, I don't like that. Like, I bought the thing, I want the feature. But as an automaker, when you're looking at, how the market is shifting and you're looking to maybe create some recurring revenue, take a software sales model, I can see how it's a natural move. It's kind of customer hostile, but, some people are going to pony up for it. So.
Yeah, and software updates, it costs money to develop them and validate them and distribute them. I mean, there's bandwidth associated with, over-the-air updates. Today, OTA updates are mostly just done. The first company to do it, bumper to bumper like this was Tesla. And, the bandwidth costs for Tesla as their fleet grew larger have gotten pretty significant. They used to do all the OTA updates directly over the cellular connection, the cellular data connection. Now, if you don't buy a premium connectivity package from Tesla, you have to have your car connected to your Wi-Fi to get those updates because of the cost of the bandwidth. The same is going to be true for everybody else. If you're connected to Wi-Fi, you'll get the updates for free. Otherwise, you'll have to have a subscription to the connectivity package. It's like using your phone. You use data on your phone, you got to pay your cellular provider for that. And car makers somebody's got to pay for that as well. When you've got tens of millions of cars on the road that need updates, that's a lot of data. Manufacturers are looking, there's companies looking at, how can we reduce the size of those updates, so there's not as much data. But, one of the nice things about this, you mentioned, having your car sit running in the driveway for 2 hours while it updates the OS and the maps. All of this stuff on these new vehicles is going to happen in the background. It's just going to happen seamlessly. It'll download the update. When it's all done, it'll install it, and then it'll just depending on what the update is, in some cases it'll just flip over while you're driving. It'll just switch from one partition to another.
Maybe not while you're driving.
Like things like maps.
Yeah,
you know,
okay,
you
maps.
Can do that. You can do that on the fly.
Sure.
Safety critical systems, those, the next time you start the car, it will switch over.
Yeah, and it'll come up with all the kind of lawyer screens you got to click through like 9 times. Like, yes, I really want to do this. Yeah. it's going to be an interesting few years as they get their software game together. But I do agree that the idea of having to subscribe to a feature you already bought is offensive to me. I don't like that. I don't expect that my opinion is going to change what happens, but I will do my best to avoid buying a car.
Well, actually, it will have an impact because, you know, manufacturers are going to look at, you know, okay, what, you know, because they have to figure out how to price this stuff and figure out, okay, what are the features that people are going to be willing to pay for or not? A great example was BMW with CarPlay. You know, a couple of years ago, they said, okay, you know, you're going to have to pay $80 a year for Apple CarPlay if you want to use it in your BMW. And there was so much uproar over that, you know, within less than a year, they changed it and went back and said, okay, it's just going to be a one-time charge when you buy the car, then you don't have to ever pay for it again. Similarly, when they, you know, announced they're doing over-the-air updates earlier this year, and I think we talked about this, you know, the idea of paying for a subscription to something like heated seats. You know, I talked to BMW about that, and they said that, you know, it's going to vary by market depending, you know, what we think the consumer acceptance is going to be. In North America, they probably will not do that by subscription.
Well, I mean, it's just like that's...
But in some markets, they will.
That's abusive, though. And the idea that they would have to roll that out, and like with CarPlay, it just astounds me that there's no better way to figure that out than really frustrating a lot of customers and taking a hit to your brand image. And like, there had to have been a better way to float that trial balloon than just doing it and getting everybody agitated.
Yeah, I agree. But that's what they did. And, you know, but I think it's a lesson that I think everybody in the industry is going to be learning over the next several years, is trying to figure out how to do this stuff.
All right. Well, I think we have answered that and then some. So that's about it for episode 170. So thanks everybody for listening. Mass is ended. Go in peace to love and drive your car. you know where to find us. Anyway, we are at feedback@wheelbearings.media. We're on all the social medias, and let us know what's up, and we'll keep answering the questions. So thanks for listening.
Godspeed.
Bye.
Godspeed, guys.
It's time to get that hernia repaired. And who better to do it than a leading clinical facility? JBR Clinical Research is currently recruiting participants for an investigational pain reduction medication study following hernia repair surgery. If you're between the ages of 18 to 75, you may qualify to receive study-related medication and no-cost hernia repair by a board-certified surgeon. You may even be compensated up to $2,000 for time and travel. To participate, call 801-261-2000 or apply at JBR Clinical Research.
Is your aging AC system ready for summer? Are you sure? Don't get caught when it's hot out. Instead, plan ahead with a free AC system inspection by Kelly's Heating and Cooling. Kelly's cares. So this spring, they're offering free home HVAC inspections. Appointments booked before the end of April might qualify for up to $8,900 back on a new high-efficiency, space-saving Daikin Fit system. So make sure you can take the heat this summer. Search for Kelly's Cooling online, because they're more than hot air. Kelly's cares.